Welcome to the Profit-Led Podcast, where we discover proven growth strategies for bootstrapped entrepreneurs from the people who have done it before to help you accelerate your business. The Profit-Led Podcast is brought to you by eWebinar, the leading automated webinar platform, which could save you from doing the same webinar over and over again, from sales demos to onboarding to training. eWebinar turns any video into an interactive webinar that you can set on a recurring schedule or make available on demand, which means you can do hundreds of webinars without ever needing to actually be there to host them live. This podcast is a forum for the unsung heroes of SaaS, the founders and others behind bootstrapped startups who are creative and resourceful enough to forge a pathway to success. Here is where they get to share everything they learned along the way, so you can benefit from their experience and find success in your own ventures too.
Welcome to Profit Led Season 2, Episode 9, where we're giving you a window into eWebinar's journey to a million, how to build a company with very little resources. My name is Melissa Kwan, and I'm the co-founder and CEO of eWebinar, and I'm here with my co-host, Todd Parmley, COO of eWebinar. Todd, how's it going?
It's good. We're in a same room at the same time.
For the first time. For this recording.
Yes. And years.
And we are in Bangkok.
I know.
So. And when was the last time you were in Asia?
Last time I was in Asia, I was 18 and I went to mainland China for 2 weeks. It was amazing.
And why have you not come back ever since?
I don't know. That's a problem, but I will be returning shortly.
So what is your first impression of Bangkok?
First of all, I didn't realize it would be so flat. So I just immediately, I don't know why.
Yeah. I mean, it's got like tons of buildings.
Yes.
Just, you think it'd be like hilly.
Yeah. Or like, yeah, there would be more topography, but it's massive. It's bustling. I mean, it's beautiful. The food so far is insane. Like literally not a bad meal.
I mean, the topography is like concrete jungle.
Yes. Yeah.
You haven't seen much because we haven't left my neighborhood.
That's true.
But maybe tonight. Yeah, okay. So last episode, we talked about launching the products, having people see it for the first time.
Yes.
And getting people on it for the first time and converting 85% of our trial users.
Yes.
And today we're going to talk about we launched product, now what?
Right.
So some of the good and bad surprises, what we're going to do next, some of the misconceptions, I guess, or some of the bets we made that worked out and didn't work out. So maybe we should start with what you thought, I guess, when we just launched the product. Like, how are you feeling? Because it was like a year and a half, right? We were working on it for a year and a half in a silo, people seeing it for the first time. Like, what was that like?
I mean, we were dying to get it out. So there was that. There was so much buildup to us launching it. And then also just remember, just like in the timeline of things, we were mid-COVID, right? We were like right smack dab in the middle of COVID. And I had been working for this other company 4 days a week. I basically negotiated this deal where I could work 4 days a week for them and 1 day for eWebinar. I wasn't working a lot for eWebinar, but I was super plugged in. But after we launched, like 2 months later, I was kind of gone. They basically, in the middle of the pandemic, they're like, dude, you have to work for us full time or we can't keep you as a consultant. So I was around for 2 months after the launch. So I feel like I was mostly there for the afterglow. You know what I mean?
Like, or like whatever the opposite of the afterglow is.
Well, I mean, we had something like it was very clear in spite of like things that went wrong or things that we thought would work that didn't or whatever. But like we had something.
Yeah.
So, you know, I just felt really encouraged. I didn't have to actually deal with some of those things very much in the next year till I came back full time. So,
yeah,
I just remember being really excited that people loved the product. I knew we had something. There was no question.
Yeah. I mean, for context for listeners here, you had to work full time because we couldn't pay you full time. I know we talked about that in the earlier episodes, but for anyone who missed it, you were a New York executive.
Right.
Had been in a couple startups that didn't work out. Your savings had dwindled and you needed to just rebuild your bank account. And so we brought you on for projects as a contractor. And that was about the time where we thought, okay, like, you need to go do what you need to do. We'll take it from here and see what else we need help on after we put this out there.
Yeah. I mean, I got really lucky because I couldn't believe they agreed to letting me work 4 days a week for them. So I was.
But that wasn't the case right away.
Well, before that, I was in a non-compete. I couldn't work at all. So I was in webinar full time.
Yeah.
And then one day a week and then 0 days a week.
Yeah.
I guess my point is that after the launch, I sort of left you to deal with.
Yeah. I mean,
all the problems.
I think it's not as dramatic as that, right? Yeah, I think a lot of people think about launching as like this one big celebratory event that's like the end goal to a marathon, right? But I've launched products before.
Yeah.
And my very, very first startup was like an events platform in Vancouver, right? Mm-hmm. Where I was living. The real Vancouver in Canada, not the fake Vancouver.
Where's the fake Vancouver?
In Washington.
Oh, right.
See, there you go. You don't even know where it is. But I remember like working on this thing for a few months, like had a contractor as well, put it out there. And then like nobody came to my website. And in that moment, I was like, oh shit, like launching something is really hard.
Yeah.
It's not like a restaurant where there's foot traffic.
Yeah.
And that was 14 years ago. So I learned that launching products is like, I don't even use the word launch. I say release or like something like that because it makes it feel like it's this one big celebratory thing where it is really the beginning of your company.
Yeah.
And when you put too much effort on it, like a lot of people, like they buy PR, right? They try to get people to write about it. And then you kind of lose steam very quickly because your first launch is not going to be very good, right? Like your products out there, it might not work. You don't know what bugs are there. Yeah. You don't know how people are going to react. So it's actually the opposite, I think, of a celebratory event. I almost want to hide it. That's the advice I give other people is like, don't position it as like this one big thing because then all eyes are going to be on your failure.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like we did hide it. We basically had, we didn't like do some big announcement.
Yeah.
We didn't blast anything out. There were people that you talked to about using it, but we just switched it on. But the way it was a launch for me is the fact that we'd been building for 18 months. So we were just like, oh my God, can we please put this out there and get people using it? But other than that, no advertising. We just like, it was super stealth. Just put it out there.
Like we made the website live.
Yeah, we made the website live.
And
we didn't tell anybody.
Yeah, like there was a list that I told because I've been talking to them. I wanted people to sign up, but it wasn't like, okay, let's release this to the world. In some ways it was.
Yeah.
But I think for me, it was, it's good and bad, right? I think one is like, okay, it's out there because we picked a date because we were working on it for so long. David, our CTO, was like, let's just get this out there. And we picked a date. It was like July 1st or something.
Yeah.
And then September 1st was supposed to be like the first day the trial was going to be over because we gave everybody 2 months trial to buy ourselves more time to like work on the Stripe integration so we could take payment. But for me, it was like great that it's out there.
Yeah.
But as a founder, it's like where reality really sets in, right? Where everything you have said to your team and your friends and your family and everyone in your business community, like this is where you either validate or, you know, everything that you said, like the dream that you sold was going to be invalidated.
Yeah, for sure.
Right. So like, you know, I think before a product is out there is when everything's going to work super well. Right. Like they sell. I think that's why people raise money before they have a product is because everything's going to be super good.
Yeah. Right.
But once you put it out there, you're like, OK, what am I going to do now? No one's signing up or like people are signing up, but they don't like the product or they don't want to pay for it. So there was a lot of like, OK, I've just sold Todd on this, our team on this, David, my life partner, my CTO, my co-founder is working on this. And all eyes are now looking at me to be like, OK, now what? What's next? So that reality check of like, okay, this might not be very easy, like started to sink in right away.
Right. Let's talk about what happened. So, so we put it out there. And what do you remember were some of like the specifics of things we learned pretty quickly?
Yeah, I mean, just focusing on like very product related, what happened with the product. I think we took some bets, right?
Yeah.
When we, and we talked about this in an earlier episode as well, like we asked ourselves, what would an automated webinar solution be like if it was invented today?
Yeah, right.
If we did not copy other people. So it's a bit of like first principles thinking where you're like, okay, like well, let's start from scratch and challenge every exception or every assumption that's out there, everything that's built. And how would we build this?
Yeah.
So we built it, yes, with a webinar function, but more like video editor.
Right.
The way you create a webinar is you upload a video instead of setting the schedule where it's a live event, right? You, because everything is centered around the video. So you upload the video first, you add interactions on it like a timeline editor in a video editing software. Right. So we weren't sure if people were going to understand how to use it.
We looked at other products that were out there that were in this category, right? And it was helpful to see like what they were doing really badly. So that was also helpful. Like we were trying to think like, okay, yes, let's, if we had no foreknowledge, we were building this today, what would it be? But having the competition to look at, or having the things that had been, even though they were what they were.
We're not delusional, right? So there was also a sense of, we're challenging what's out there, but is what's out there what works?
Yeah, right.
So that's the risk that we took. Yeah, is like, exactly. Okay, a perfect example of that is you go to any webinar software, you've got a chat interface, like the chat box.
Yeah.
Which expands into a panel. And then you've got your polls and stuff. That's on a completely different tab.
Yeah.
So why isn't the chat and the polls and all the stuff you play with on the same screen?
Yeah, right.
And then when we started doing research, all of them were like that. All of them were on different tabs. So then we started wondering, did one just copy the other?
Yeah, it definitely felt like it. I mean, literally, they were all the same.
Yeah. The other thing that we took a huge risk on, which is our 10 times feature, right? The feature that we took time building that we think people are going to switch for was the idea of this asynchronous chat, right? Like a Zendesk intercom-like chat that you could respond in real time or later through email. It's never been done before.
Right. In the context of
in the context of a webinar, whether it's live or automated. So are people going to understand what that means and how to use that? In the beginning, like I had watched people, I had probably watched the first like 50 to 80 people create their first webinar, right? That was like part of our learnings, right? Part of our kind of like our CS, right? So the pleasant surprise was people felt it was like the product was pretty natural and it was part of the design, right? Like we designed it because we knew it was going to be product led. So we designed it in a way where it was one step at a time. The product would guide you through the first few steps. And if you wanted to edit it later, you would already know what would happen.
Right. And you could see what you were creating as you created it, which was also something that was not common. Like you, in a lot of other solutions, you had to publish before you could even see any of the work that you'd done. You couldn't preview your registration pages. So simple things that we'd learned like that, like our big bets were chat, right? Let's do chat in a totally different way, which, by the way, everyone was like, no one had really thought about the idea of if it's pre-recorded, they were like, oh, if it's pre-recorded, then you have to be there to answer chat. And if you can't, you just turn chat off. I was like, wait, why can't there be this middle ground? Something that seemed so obvious to us, but that had never been done. And then the editor was the other thing, right, that you had mentioned. And what was the creation process, right? One of our big bets was let's make the creation process so easy that you wouldn't need
but any different.
So straightforward that anybody could do it without any instruction. And that was one where I feel like we learned some things, but we kind of nailed it.
Yeah. And then there was also the question of our attendees, like webinar attendees, right? Our customers, are they going to like what we put out there? Because if you think about a Zoom or go to a webinar, it's just black screen. It's like a boardroom where you go in, someone's talking at you, there's a chat, there's Q&A, but that's it, right? But it feels very corporate, right? Like very sterile. And we took a chance to be like, what if people could brand it with their logo, their colors? What if the interactions felt beautiful and more consumer, right? We took inspiration from like live streaming software, Twitch, Netflix, and all those things, and not other webinar software. And then we added reactions, right? Like we took inspiration from Instagram Live, Facebook Live. What if you could hit a thumbs up? And as you're watching the webinar, it would have like all these thumbs that are floating up. Like stuff that you're already doing in your everyday life, right? So we didn't take inspiration from B2B software, business software, right? We took inspiration from consumer software because we are consumers.
Right.
Every single business user is a consumer. But we weren't sure if people were going to be like, oh, this is childish or this is really cool.
Yeah.
And I think the good part is, and we were the first consumers of our own, the first users of our own product because I had run it for the company I was working for. People were like, oh, what is this? This is really cool. What software is this? So it was really nice to see that people accepted it right away and they didn't think it was out of the box or weird. But that told me something that we're onto something because it was such a natural progression from where it used to be.
One of our guiding principles was, what is the attendee experience going to be? Because it really does feel like everybody else was focusing on making sure the user of the software got everything they needed, but the attendee experience felt like an afterthought. So seeing people who had used other platforms talk about how much better our attendee experience was another braid thing. So I feel like we're talking about mostly the good things.
Yeah, that's true. But there were some not so positive things, like reactions, right? Just reactions in general, right? From our users. Those are the good reactions. But some of the not so positive ones were like, oh, I came here from this other software and you don't have all these things.
Yeah,
right. Some people were looking for feature parity, which we knew.
Yeah, we knew.
Like if you treat yourself as a user of a CRM, right? And you go to a new CRM and you're looking to switch.
Yeah.
You're looking for a minimal feature parity.
Yeah. And I think there were certain things that we kind of knew, but we immediately moved them to the front of the line of things that need to be done, mostly integrations, things about marketing tracking, things that, because we were not really experts in any of that. So we needed to learn from our customers. I don't think we could have anticipated that, honestly, because of our own background. But yeah, there was a lot of people who were like, I can't use this.
Yeah, I mean, there was also the flip side of like, oh, I use other things and I didn't like it. And now this is better. So it was like the reason why we built it is because we tried other things and it didn't exist. So we built this. So there were definitely people that were like us. They were the small majority.
Yeah.
Because we weren't really advertising it to that many people. But there definitely was like a majority that would have bought the product if we had feature parity.
But if we wanted
feature parity, we would never get this out, right? If you think about any product is going to be 2 to 5 years ahead of you. In our space, companies are 5 to 10 years ahead of us.
15, yeah.
And they have like a decade of learning from other customers to build those features in. We haven't even began to learn about those things. So that was a little bit like, I don't know if demoralizing is the word, but it was certainly like, what are we going to do now? How do we catch up? And feature parity is not always a good thing, right? I think companies that chase feature parity miss out on real opportunities, real opportunities to make your product unique.
Yeah, for sure.
Like a lot of times you don't know why that feature is there and you have to hear it from the customer to know how to build it intentionally versus like, I want to build a Facebook. I'm going to copy every single feature that Facebook has. And you can probably do that.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of nuances that are built in, even in our product, that you're not going to know by looking at the surface.
Yeah, right. The thing that I think was a little bit of a letdown too is that we had been thinking so much about how to kind of reimagine the experience of a pre-recorded webinar. And then all the features we needed to build were kind of boring features. So it's like, but they were features that would prevent us from actually selling it. It felt like to me, we sort of like just put our heads down and we're like, okay, here's the first list that is blocking these customers from actually subscribing and focused on those for a little while. And they were not sexy features. They were just like, let's get it done.
I mean, there were also like some things that were kind of disastrous, right? It just came to mind as we're talking is like, so we've got this chat feature where someone sends you a message and you get notified by email.
Yeah. Right.
Like, hey, Todd, like I have a question about this.
Yeah.
And we didn't think about this, but in the beginning, we shot an email out for every single message that came in. So if it's like, hey, Todd, enter. I have a question. Enter. So imagine in one webinar, you'd have 1,000 messages.
From one person. From or like five people. Yeah.
Yeah. And then it would just blast these accounts. And that was one thing that we had to fix right away. So then we changed it to it only sends you the email notification for the first message.
Yeah, right.
But then people started complaining and was like, well, they just said thank you. Because usually we have an automated welcome message that could say something like, welcome to my webinar.
Right.
And then somebody would type thank you. And then maybe the autoresponder would say, oh, I'm not here right now.
Right.
So then we were sending out the auto response for things that didn't need a response.
Right.
Then it made people frustrated because whatever reason. And so we had to change that right away. And like, to the best of our ability, guess what the messages that didn't need responses are.
Right.
And so that was a kind of a fast follow. And then of course, everybody was complaining about integrations. And we knew we had to integrate with Zapier, but there was like an approval process and all that stuff. It was taking like 2 or 3 weeks to do, but it would have been 2 or 3 weeks later than the time that we had allotted ourselves. So we were just like, okay, let's just push it out there right now.
Another thing that really we learned is like, this was kind of built with a CS use case in mind, right?
Yeah, like for my own like customer success
experience, right? Like, how do you onboard users at scale, right? That kind of thing. So we kind of had a grip on that use case more than anything else because of your experience. But there was, we didn't know much about the sales and marketing use case.
Yeah. I mean, I did demos.
Right.
I did software demos, but software demos is not like people that have a complete automated sales funnel to sell a product or a course.
Right.
And we were part of that optimized sales funnel.
Yeah, right.
And they wanted like tracking scripts. They wanted landing page widgets to, they didn't want to use our landing page because it wasn't optimized. And then they wanted to install a widget. And these are all things that we saw in our competitors' products.
Yeah.
But we hadn't gotten to it yet. And we didn't really know the use case. If you try to build at feature parity, you're actually at risk of overbuilding, maybe for the customer that you don't want to serve.
Right.
But all those widgets and stuff, those were also fast falls. And when I say fast falls, they were like 3 to 4 months.
Yeah, that's
it wasn't right away, right?
But also think about that. Like the landing pages we built were very, very simple, right?
Yeah.
And I had assumed that we were going to need to make them much better, add more modules, make them like they were going to need a lot of attention because they were so simple. And honestly, what we learned is that this crowd that does this sort of course creators, entrepreneurs, individual marketers.
Yeah, the people that care about landing pages.
Yeah, they want sophisticated landing pages. And so they were using sophisticated landing page software.
Yeah, like lead pages where they could pay like $20 for and have everything.
And have everything. Yeah. And there was no way we were going to compete in that space. So the way we handled that is, okay, let's just create we have more like options for marketing widgets than anyone else, right? Yep. So if you want to put a button, a form, like the way it works, how it looks, like we did that really, really well and didn't really enhance our landing pages. And that I would have never guessed that.
Yeah. And 3 years later now, our product's been out for 3 years. Yeah. We're still getting suggestions for new widgets that people want, like two-step registration, or I want a button here, I don't want a button here, or like this is too slow because it's affecting my SEO, like all this stuff that we are still to this day trying to make better for a subset of our customers. But to your point, like we really built this for my onboarding and training and my personal experience with delivering sales demos for a low-cost product. But there were so many other use cases, even within those functions, right?
Oh,
within a trainer, like that trainer wants different things. Within a person that does sales demos, they want a different CTA. And then within the marketers, they want a different script on a different thing and a different offer and a pin a different way. And they want they want the offer to be on top of the video and not on the panel. They want to be able to charge people on the same tab and not bounce into a different tab. Like it was just endless.
Yeah, it was endless. Yeah, there was a lot we didn't know.
Hey. I'd like to take a second here to talk about my own company, eWebinar, and our mission to rescue people from what I call webinar hell, to give them back their time and save them literally hundreds of hours every month through webinar automation. If your sales team is tired of doing the same demo over and over for unqualified leads or worse, prospects who don't even show up, an on-demand demo powered by eWebinar can help them get their time back so they can close more deals. If you're doing customer onboarding and training on repeat, eWebinar can help you automate those so you never have to do them live again. Customer success teams are using eWebinar to run hundreds of sessions every single month without a live host. Why don't you give our product a try and see for yourself? Visit eWebinar.com to join our own on-demand demo or to sign up for a free trial. All right, now that I've gotten that on my system, let's get back to the episode.
I think there was another thing that we didn't expect was like we really built this product to be really dummy proof.
Oh, yeah.
Like super simple, 5 steps, product walks you through. You can't do anything outside of uploading a video first.
Right.
That was the first screen. We just had these like super dumb users that came in that was like, what do I do now? And you're like, did you even look? And we don't have a CS team. It was just like the three of us.
Yeah, right.
Trying to answer. So then you're trying to build a product, trying to market, trying to sell, trying to fix things.
Yeah.
And now you've got majority of people that figure it out on their own.
Yeah.
But the minority of people that just sucks up all of your time. And then in the beginning, you want to make everybody happy because every dollar counts. Right. So then you're like, do I spend time on this person or not?
Yeah.
And then you realize like the people that are the least tech savvy.
Yes.
Are also the least likely to convert after trial. And even if they pay, they're least likely to stay because they just don't have any clue because they're not just not tech savvy on your product. They're not tech savvy in their entire business. So at the same time, they're trying to set up their CRM, their MailChimp, and they have equal amount of questions. Right.
Right.
So at some point you're like, oh, let's just like give them. And then we started using these questions to write like help articles and to kind of lower our own support.
The product manager in me always feels like there's got to be a way to. But these are customers you don't really want to have because they can't figure out anything. So it's like, yes, the customer is always right, but not in this case, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, also in the beginning, like we're talking like very early on, we had no knowledge base, no videos, no webinars of our own. Oh, so very quickly, it was like, how do we lower own support? How do we work the least in the business, right? So, you know, we already had HubSpot set up, so our knowledge base was going to be there. So it was just like me doing instructional videos, right? Like 2 minute videos at a time. This is how you upload. This is the schedule. This is what you do. And then like one long video, and then you are turning those into written articles. We're doing copy and paste answers for the support chat.
But for a lot of this time, I was not working for you. So like it was.
You were, I think, on the weekends.
Yes, on the weekends.
Yeah, on the weekends.
But all I'm saying is it was a lot on you. Like, I felt really
I'll
bad.
I'll take the credit.
I was like, yes, I was helping as much as I could, but I mean, it was like it was tough.
There were two like biggest shocking surprises, good and bad.
Yeah.
I think one was like how enthusiastic some people were. Like that was really energizing and really encouraging.
Yeah.
Like, especially after building in a silo, we took all these bets. We weren't sure if people were going to like it. And if we even had a business.
Yes.
At that point, like we'd sunk in, I want to say 400,000 into the business already. Like David and I wrote the first check.
Yeah.
Right. We had some friends and family. Like you were one of our first investors as well. Like, but we didn't know if people were going to like it. And if they don't like it, you have two choices, right? You can keep going. Keep burning money and keep iterating, which is what we would have done.
Right.
Or at that point, if you run out of money, you have to make a really tough call, right? Like, do I shut this down? Do I take another side gig? Yeah. Right. So that it was really encouraging to know that at least some people really loved it. So we enough that to know we were onto something because we did convert 85% of our initial batch of users. And I think the first month we made like $3,500.
Right.
But that's not insignificant.
No,
right?
It's not. From zero to 3,500 having, and it's a complex product. It's not like you're putting some tiny product out there. Registration pages, notifications, webinar room, like all of this stuff. And that was the most encouraging thing to me is that it wasn't a neutral response. Like, yeah, we had some negatives, but most of the people were saying, I can't use this yet because this is missing. So reality did sink in of like all the stuff we were going to have to deal with. But I remember thinking, thank God.
Me too.
You know, because I was like, I believed in it, but you never know till you know.
But so the people that loved it. Loved it enough to start tweeting about it, writing us unsolicited testimonials. And usually these are people who have looked at other products. They were in our boat. They never used something else. And they finally found something that they could use. And they were really excited about it. And they wanted to tell the world about it. And then random people started finding us. So I think that was like the biggest positive surprise.
Yeah.
But I think the biggest negative surprise was like how not everyone got it right away.
Oh, yeah.
And that was so, it was very discouraging, equally discouraging.
And
because
let me just explain what you mean by got it, just so for context, is that to us, it was so clear the value of an automated webinar, of making, of pre-recording a webinar and putting it on autopilot in a way that would still allow people to ask questions, make it an interactive experience. It was such a no-brainer and people just didn't get it. They're like, isn't that just a video? Like, how could that possibly be better than a video? And I mean, I guess the good thing was, is that was my original reaction to the idea. If you remember, I was like, I don't get it. So, but by then I really understood the idea. And so I was like, oh yeah, right. Oh yeah, right. I had to make it over like this initial hump to sort of get the vision. It was like, oh, this is not readily apparent to people.
I mean, for me as a founder, it's a bit of a different perspective, right? Because I was so close to the problem for 5 years in my last company. I hated doing live webinars over and over. Right. I was the only CS person. I was the only salesperson in my tiny bootstrap startup selling my enterprise SaaS. I did all the onboarding, all the training. I was traveling. So I was doing this on opposite time zones. I was doing demos for customers that were paying like $100 a month. And most of them didn't even want to pay at the end of the demo. It doesn't matter if you're demoing your product that's at $10, $100, $1,000 or 100,000.
Yeah.
It is the exact same demo.
Over and over.
Over and over. Yeah. So I was the person doing that in my last startup. So I had 5 years of that. So I couldn't even conceive that somebody would look at this and not be like ecstatic.
And it was also really obvious that we had a solution to that problem.
Yeah.
Like it was like, oh, this works. This actually solves this problem. And then nobody saw it.
Yeah. I mean, some people saw it, but like the most frustrating thing was like, they were like, so how does it work? Right. And don't forget, we're in the middle of the pandemic. We're in the middle of 2020. Every single person in the world, if they were not using Zoom before, they were using Zoom now. So webinars, Zoom, live meetings, like they were all synonymous with running a business.
Yeah.
Everyone was saying they were not going to go back to live events because this is so much cheaper and they're not going to fly trainers out anymore. And so you're like, well, this is the obvious solution.
Yeah.
Right. So then people are like, but like, how does it work? So it's automated. Do I need to staff it 24/7? I don't have staff 24/7.
Right.
So then I'm like, oh my God, how stupid are you? You've got an intercom bubble sitting on your website. It's the exact same thing. Do you staff your intercom bubble?
Yeah.
Actually, we still have this problem.
Yeah.
It still blows my mind. And people have no imagination.
I remember in our first website, everything was like, sign up now. And then we were like, no. No one's going to sign up now because they don't understand what it is. So everything became join the demo because we use eWebinar to run our demo. So people would have a firsthand experience and be like, oh, because I remember we would answer something in chat in the demo. They'd be like, oh, my God, I just got an answer in a pre-recorded demo from someone live. And it was like you could see the light bulb going on for them.
I mean, there was such a big fear, and that fear still exists. It's like, if people know that I'm not live, they're going to think I'm faking them out. They're going to see me as a lesser company. They're going to see this as a less effective webinar. But I'm like, when was the last time you watched something on like live cable TV, right? Like we can't even imagine watching a show that's not on Netflix.
Right. Unless it's like the Super Bowl or some like
countdown, right? Like New Year's countdown.
Exactly.
But people still to this day have a fear that automating a webinar means they're tricking people. It's like, well, it's only tricking people if you tell them it's live when it's not. It's a trick when you deceive them, but it's not when you either not say anything, you don't position it as live, you don't say, hey, I'm live when you're not. Yeah. Like, that's where the tricking comes in. So there's a lot of like conditioning, I think, that maybe happened in the past because like the products that existed before us were designed to trick consumers. They had fake counters, fake chat conversations, right? Like fake sales notifications, fake scarcity. We made a conscious effort to not build those features so that people would look at this and know that this is a product with integrity. And we built it with a beautiful experience, with a chat, with autoresponders that let people know you're not there, right? Yeah. We're like completely above board.
Right.
But either people have seen past webinar solutions before that were in this space and thought, oh, that was kind of like scammy and dirty and I don't want to use it, which was like us.
Yeah.
Or people are like, oh, like I've never seen this before, but does that mean I'm like, does that mean this is a worse webinar because people know that I'm not live? So there was still kind of this mental hum, but that's why we use our product to demo the product, because you're in the experience as if you are your customer. And as soon as people see that, they're like, okay, and now I know how it works. And now I need to either digest that myself or convince my champion or like my boss that this is something that I want to do. But other shocking surprises when you talk to more customers coming in or prospects coming in was like people were problem aware. Like they were like, yeah, I hate doing live webinars. Like I hate my life, but they don't want to solve the problem.
Yeah.
That shocks me. It still does. But that all came like basically in the first couple months where we're like, what's wrong with these people?
Yeah, I felt like some people felt like they needed to protect their jobs. Like,
They were like intentionally not telling companies or intentionally telling companies that they needed to go live because their customers wanted them to be there and their customers
needed to be there live.
So it didn't seem like a good excuse, but then whoever is their boss needs them there.
Yeah. Right.
So then they needed to keep them in that job.
Yeah. And there was some, I feel like, even who like, so this is going to sound a little twisted, but they like sort of reveled in the fact that they were like, had so much to do it. Like, I mean, you know what I mean? Those sort of
like a busybody in a corporate.
Yeah. Busybody in a corporate.
It still happens. Yeah. I think people listening can identify with that. It's like, if this isn't my job, then what is my job?
Yeah.
And they don't think bigger, right? If I remove this from my plate, I can do so much more. But there were other cases where the C-suite would be like, no, this is what you're using.
Yeah. Right.
Figure it out.
especially that we're talking about mostly the CS use case right now, right?
Yeah.
Is that,
I mean, sales also, like, yeah, I mean, sales people are notorious for saying, I need to talk to my customer. Yeah, if I'm not there, they're not going to buy. Like, they want the lead, right? They're not going to want to open this up.
Okay, so that's exactly the same problem again, is like people on the before were like, I can't solve this problem, or I don't want to solve this problem, right? Meanwhile, the people who actually started using our product were like, oh my God, I can make more content than ever. I never imagined I'd be able to get past just doing two or three webinars a month because it was just too much. Now they're like creating this whole suite of webinars, or sales teams that were like, oh my God, the leads that come to us after watching our e-webinar are now ready to close and they've been pre-educated, but we still weren't able to get people to see that. You know what I'm saying? Like we started using testimonials and all that, but
we didn't have that. So the hardship, I guess, in convincing people is you don't have testimonials, you don't have case studies.
Yeah.
I'm saying this is good, but what other people say will always be 10 times more credible than what you say. Yeah. But luckily, I was working for HomeSpotter, who bought my company Spacio, and I was the first use case. So then I used Aaron, the CEO, to make our first case study. And I was like, well, look what this guy's saying. But you just need to get people in the product, but you can't win everybody. But it was just a realization of like, okay, people don't get it right away. I would say 20% of the people got it. Like maybe 10% of the people wanted to sign up right away. Majority of them needed convincing. People need to see it. They need to think about it. They need to have other people in their company see it.
Yeah.
A small percentage didn't even want to introduce it to their company. So then we realized we had to go a bit higher.
Yeah.
Like if we even wanted to sell it, because I was doing one-on-one sales, right? I was doing founder-led sales.
Right.
Like we weren't really doing the marketing stuff that we're doing right now. I think all of this told me, at least, that the market wasn't as ripe as we thought. And that was the huge weight that I started to feel was like, oh my God, like my financial projections, and I always have a financial projections, and it was projected at that point 2 years out. I do it 1 year out now because we're more stable, but back then it was like 2 years out. I projected us to hit a million ARR in a year. Mm. Some companies have done it. I'm now learning that that's like unicorn porn.
Yeah.
Like that only the companies that reported on hit a million in a year. It's very, very rare. Like we hit it in 3 years. I think the average across all startups funded and not funded is like, I think at 2.5 or 3 years. So we're like right in the average. Yeah, if they get there. And there are some huge companies that we know of that got there like in year 4 and 5 and then accelerated very quickly.
Yeah.
But I projected that because that's all the cash we had.
I know, right.
So it was like, okay, now you've got this weight on your shoulder because you realize people aren't like knocking at your door, wanting to buy and signing up on their own. Like I really thought that when people saw this, that their eyes were going to light up and they were going to think, finally, there's this thing to solve my problem. What do I do now? How do I sign up? Where do I pay you? How do I expand? So that process was just a lot longer than I thought it would be.
Yeah. I mean, I feel so bad because I feel like I abandoned you in that period. Because I wasn't as connected anymore, right? And then I would check in with you and you were really feeling the full weight of this. It was like 8 months after, maybe it was 8 months after we launched on Product Hunt, that I came back full time and started really wrestling with these problems in the same way you did it. And I think that was kind of a relief for you.
Yeah, I mean, let's think about like, I'm trying to think back to how much money I was spending in those early days, right? Like I wasn't paying myself, right? So I only started paying myself in the last few months, right? And it's been 5 years after incorporation, right? 3.5 years since like, the product was live. And I just started paying myself in the last few months. You are getting paid by project. I forgot what you were getting paid on. David, he had a side hustle. Consulting fee that he was getting from another company monthly. So that helped.
Yeah.
But I think we were paying him $5,000 a month. And he has like two kids. He has to pay child support. Yeah, right. He has an ex-wife. Like we have a life as well. Right. And luckily I had some savings from my previous sale. We were paying a Vietnam team. So then we had 3 full-time developers there. So I think that was like, depending on seniority, I think we were paying like a little under $10,000 maybe. And then, you know, Amazon and that cost wasn't racked up back then. But that was like the very, very basic. And then I was looking at like, who can help me on marketing? At that point, I had no idea what marketing was. Where do we need to spend money? So I think we were at least burning 25K and then making like, imagine 3,000 the first month, 4,000 the second month. So you're like, okay, now yeah, I gotta change these projections and see how long I can stretch for with the money in my bank. And also thinking, if I had to write another check for the company, how much does it have to be? What am I willing to write?
Yeah, right.
Right, because it's not like I exited for a ton of money. So it's like, if I had to write a second check, how big does it have to be and how long would that last?
Yeah.
Right. So now you're starting to calculate this, what I call a zero cash date.
Right.
When do you run out of money and when do you hit profitability? Which is why, like, I love doing projections, right? Because it tells you exactly how much you can spend and when, right, when you're going to run out of money, how many of each subscription level you're going to need to have subscribed in order to make that revenue. So I actually have a financial projections model that I can share actually in the show notes of this episode. It's just a Google Doc that you can duplicate.
Yeah, right.
But it's super helpful to know. So I started redoing all that stuff and like sweating bullets.
I mean, I feel like this is actually kind of a good place to wrap up because everything is leading towards what we're going to talk about in the next episode.
True.
Which is like, okay, so yeah, it went well. Yeah, we have a business idea. Or it's all, you know, this thing works. We have a company, but the reality has set in and now the clock is ticking, right? You need revenue if you're going to continue. So in the next episode, we're going to talk about everything related to founder-led sales, which is what you dove into.
Yeah. And we also have an episode later on marketing strategies right, that worked, that didn't, our $0 marketing strategies that we ended up trying over time. And you mentioned we launched on Product Hunt, which we did. Yeah. One of the things that we're going to talk about later, but just to give the audience a timeline is like, first time I used the product under my company, HomeSpotter, was like first week of July.
Yeah.
And we picked that weekend or we picked that week because it was a holiday and it wasn't going to be, we weren't going to be flooded. It was going to be like an imaginable crowd. Yeah. And then first time somebody paid was September 1st. That was when we converted 85% of our users. And I think we launched in Product Hunt in November.
Yeah, it was like first or second week of November.
And that was like one of the marketing strategies that we tried that we're going to dive into. We're not going to say whether it worked or not. Yeah. So what is your hot take for today's conversation?
People can't see what you see. They can't imagine what you imagine. They don't know what you know. Like, as disappointing as it was to realize that people were not lighting up when they saw the product for the first time, they're like, oh my God, I have to have this.
It's a disappointment.
Oh my God.
I think so many founders are like nodding right now.
Yeah.
Right. Like, have their own version.
Yeah. And there was like a little bit of a period of acceptance. It's like, oh, okay. All right. Now we have to get to work, but at least we knew we had something.
Yeah. I mean, I think my hot take is don't assume you know everything, which was like the mistake that I made. Mm. Like I assumed my problem was the only problem, was the biggest problem. And in that assumption, I thought everyone was going to get it. And because I thought everyone was going to get it, I thought sales were going to be easy. And then I didn't project my cost properly and my revenue properly. Mm. Because I projected there to be a lot more revenue, I also didn't build in a marketing cost because I'm a sales background. I'm not in marketing. So I would have budgeted better and spent a lot less money if I knew the money that I had to stretch for a lot longer. So I think always challenge your own assumptions. And even though you're super close to a problem, there are 10 other versions of that problem that you're not seeing. And I guess the biggest problem is not everyone who has the problem even wants to solve it.
Yeah. They're not willing. They can't, you know, whatever.
Whatever reason, whatever right? Reasons. You can't force them. Like, just because people have a problem doesn't mean they're going to buy your thing. Like, they're like, I have the problem. So now what? It's crazy, right?
Yeah. It's really crazy.
Yeah. But that's it for today's episode.
Yeah.
So thank you for listening in to our first live episode, recorded live.
Yep.
If you enjoyed today's episode, please take a moment to maybe share it with your friends. The only way this podcast grows is by word of mouth. So if you take a moment to share it with someone that you think could benefit, like you, that would mean the world to us. And if there are any other topics that you want us to talk about on this podcast in this season, let me know by connecting with me on LinkedIn. My last name is spelled Kwan, K-W-A-N. And please subscribe to Profit Led on your favorite podcast app and go to our website, profitled.fm, to subscribe to our mailing list and be notified of new episodes that are coming up. Thank you so much for listening.
Thanks for listening to Profit Led. If you enjoyed this episode, we hope you will subscribe to the Profit Led podcast and head over to our website, profitled.fm, to see the show notes of every episode. You can also join our mailing list to be notified of new episodes or when we have interesting products and resources to share. we promise to only share things you'll actually care about. Thanks again for listening. Bye now.